Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you with us today as we take a look at growing plants to attract pollinators on this edition of Garden Talk. We'll take a look at prairie plants, in particular, native plant gardening for pollinators. That's what I'm calling it, with my guest, Susan Carpenter. She is the Senior Outreach Specialist in the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. And she has some tips on what native plants attract birds and bees and butterflies. And she'll also tell us about the upcoming Native Plant Gardening Conference and take your native gardening questions as well. What would you like to know about planting native plants? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Susan Carpenter, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Larry. Thanks.
So what's blooming in the native plant garden at the Arboretum?
Oh,
lots
wow.
of things.
Okay, yeah, lots of things. It's a really diverse garden, and right now we've had a really great growing season with lots of extra rain early in the season and, you know, suitable temperatures. So we've got some giant native thistles blooming. They're towering up above everything. In their second year, they get quite tall, but they are very attractive to pollinators, as though we're covered with bees and butterflies. And we also have some of our late summer blooming species are just finishing up, like our giant hyssop. And now the fall blooming species are coming in, the goldenrods, a whole different array of goldenrods, and the asters are starting as well. So we're still in full bloom over there.
Well, the warblers are, they're not insects, they're birds, but the warblers are starting to come back through on their way south. Do you see a lot of bird life out there as well?
Well, in the garden itself, we do see a lot of birds. There are a lot of seeds now from plants that have been blooming already. A lot of the grasses and some of the forbs already have seeds, of course, and the birds know exactly how to perch on those and pick those out. And so we've been seeing a lot of goldfinches, flocks of goldfinches right in the garden using seed. And then there are our swallows that nest at the building. Those are all swooping around and they're insect eaters. So that's good. And then we have hawks and all kinds of birds. The native gardens give a lot of cover for smaller animals,
sure.
And so we have the whole food chain going on there, both plants to animals to birds and to
everything
yep.
imaginable out there. Well,
exactly.
You know, and you've got some pretty large gardens out there, and you know, the average person with a lawn can still have a lot of native plants that will attract birds.
Exactly. You just need some space, and if you have a small space and you use that space and plant native plants, you will find that the insects and the birds will find your garden. So even if it's a small area, especially if it's a small area adjacent to other yards and other small areas, and as people begin to do more of this kind of gardening, we see it moving across the built landscape as well as, you know, larger areas like the Arboretum or other natural areas.
You know, I've got an area that runs between the sidewalk and the street. So, you know, that's a fairly narrow strip, but I got native plants in there, many native plants, and surprising, or maybe not surprising, it wouldn't be to you, but the variety of insects and so forth that attend to that strip that's only a few feet wide and maybe 10, 15 feet long, I guess you could say.
Right. Yeah, so that's a good example of a smaller area. And for, you know, you can be very aware of where the situation is. So like for that boulevard kind of situation, you know, you might want to use lower profile plants because you want to see when you're backing out of the driveway or when cars are going by, you want to be able to see. And we have some short gardens like that right in front of the visitor center where we keep it at a low height. If taller plants come in, we take them out and reduce their size just so that you do have those multiple uses of the area. But
Well, my coneflowers get a little higher than maybe they should, and my only problem right now is sometimes finding the newspaper in the morning when it lands in the middle of flowers. Oh, boy. John in Pewaukee has a question for you, so let's just go there. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Susan. Hi. I live in Pewaukee, like you said, and I've got a pretty big lot for the city. And the front yard, I converted about 14 years ago to all native plants, Joe Pye weed, compass plant, basically everything I could find, wild bergamot. And it's right now, I think it's about 12 feet, like a Joe Pye weed over my head, 12 feet.
Yeah. And
before I did it, it was just a desert, just a lawn, and and it was by this time of year, it was pretty much dead grass because it's on a hill and it gets full sun. It's just, to me, terrible. You had a water, and I imagine before it was mine, it was chemicals were put on it.
And now it looks pretty good.
Well, to me, it does. But, the change as far as the diversity, sphinx moss, hummingbird, toad, everything, I mean, you can go down the street and you won't see a butterfly, and then you get to my lot, and it's filled with monarchs. It's just a crazy transformation. But a couple of years ago, I got a letter in the mail, and I was given a fine for noxious weeds. And I had to go to court three times, but luckily I won and got to keep my prairie. So my question and comment is, boy, with all the benefits, especially the diversity of life, how can we get people to understand how great that is and how wonderful it looks and how good it is for the environment?
Sure.
Away from lawns that take so much fossil fuels.
Yeah, absolutely, John. I'm sure that Susan has some comments. Now, we're dealing with some with neighbors and some obviously, and maybe neighbor complains or something in John's case, or maybe it was just a government person driving by and seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're bringing up a really great point. It's kind of nice to start the show with this, John. I'm glad that you stuck with it and made your case. I know that the word noxious weed is used somewhat loosely at times. In other words, if the garden that you have there isn't conventional, the plants are rather tall, some people will call those noxious weeds simply because they're tall, big plants and they are not familiar with them. So there is a technical definition of noxious weeds, and I do encourage people to make sure if they have a native planting that they haven't let it, go to the point where they're actually, seeding Canada thistles and so forth in that planting. Because there's sometimes people think that if you put the native plants into a garden, that nature then from then on is going to kind of take care of it itself, and, the balance of nature will keep everything going well. But the weeds are still, it's a heavily, highly disturbed area to begin with, as you described, it is important to keep after the weeds. So I always say to people when they do native plant gardening, you're going to be able to give up a lot of watering. You can give up fertilizer. You can give up pesticides, but you're going to be able to keep on with your weeding. You won't have to give that up. So for a time, you will be monitoring it and weeding it. As far as I think there's a big gap in education, as always, and we will need to, reach out to people and help people understand. And it could be helpful in your case if we just tackle the whole big idea, like the diversity itself that is enhanced by putting in this kind of garden. That is the basic, that's a basic principle of this kind of gardening, but it might be too much for people to absorb all at once. So sometimes using a focal point, you mentioned having lots of monarchs in your garden, sort of focusing in on something might help to communicate and teach people what are the value and what are the benefits.
And if you put even posting a sign right in front of the lawn, saying "Monarch Garden." These are prairie plantings attracting monarchs and other beneficial insects.
Yeah, that's a great idea. There's yard signs that are commercially available that highlight either monarchs or pollinators or just native plantings, and you can or you can design your own if you know and make the point that you'd like to make.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And you're absolutely right, John. The benefits are outstanding for having something like that. Let's go to Andrea in Madison next. Andrea, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I wanted to add to the answer that you just gave to the question about increasing the acceptability of wilder type gardens.
Yeah.
There have been studies that have shown that if you trim around the edge, mow a little edge or put in something indicating that you're taking care of it, I find my acceptance of my kind of wild garden is greatly improved by having a little picket fence around it. If people see that there's an edge and that there's care, then they immediately assume that that was on purpose.
Yeah.
And so that's helpful. But what I called about was to urge you to encourage people to remember that when you're attracting pollinators, also think about their larval stages. So often we think about we want to have the butterflies, but except for the monarchs, people often don't remember, well, I have to provide something for the caterpillar stage or the larval stages for them to eat, and then I'll have more butterflies. And also be tolerant of them chewing away on things. I know some people have gotten kind of disturbed that they had milkweed tussock moths on their milkweed. and those wear the same bright orange and black and white, I don't taste good colors, but only in the larval stage. So just that. Remember, plant some parsley or some of those umbelliferers for the black swallowtail, for example.
Andrea, right. Thanks.
Great points.
Comments, Susan? Additional?
Well, those are really great points. And I think what it really opens us up to is realizing that this kind of garden calls on us to pay attention more and to really learn and observe and look at what all these connections are in the garden. We can't just think that one thing is going to lead to another. There's a whole network of things to learn about. So thanks, Andrea, for that comment about the larval stage.
Yeah, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, you can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And maybe you've got a nice photo of your prairie or your native plantings. Love to see that on our Facebook page. And the title of our page is The Larry Mealer Show. Our guest, Susan Carpenter, Senior Outreach Specialist at the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. I'm Larry Mealer. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer for Garden Talk, here on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, Ben Fuda from the Allen Centennial Gardens will be with us to talk about unusual bulbs and how to incorporate them into your landscape. So I hope you'll join us for that. Right now, visiting with Susan Carpenter from the UW-Madison Arboretum, talking with her about native plant gardening for pollinators, and certainly looking forward to hearing from you at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mealer Show Facebook page. Jennifer on Facebook says it's been a really good summer for rusty patched bumblebees in Milwaukee.
Okay, that is a topic that's near and dear to me. The rusty patch bumblebee, for listeners who may not have heard, was listed as an endangered species federal protection under the Endangered Species Act last spring, and that has caused a lot more interest in finding out where does it live. And we've known known. It's lived at the been living at the Arboretum for, we've been documenting it at the Arboretum for the last 6 years, but there are other locations through Minnesota, the Twin Cities area, down through southern Wisconsin, a little into northern Illinois, where the species is still surviving. And over the rest of its range, which would be the East Coast, southern Canada in the east, and the southeast, where it has been lost and no one's found it lately. So that they're finding it in the Milwaukee area is awesome. What this, it's being found by people who are out with their cameras in likely pollinator habitat and gardens and nature centers and backyards and parks and so on, and taking pictures. And if you take adequate pictures, you upload them to bumblebeewatch.org, and that is a web portal to collect all these pictures and map them. And the IDs will be verified, so you don't even have to be a bumblebee expert to post your photos there.
That is very, very cool. So that was a Facebook question. Karen emailed to say that she's planting a new bed of native plants and wonders how she can protect them over the winter. She'd rather not use straw.
Okay, I've got a great answer for Karen. The plants themselves can just, they don't need to be mulched or covered for the winter. These, if they are native plants that are appropriate to this area, they would simply survive through the winter on their own. And what we do is the plant, it's, if there's herbaceous plants, the plant will die back. The dried material will remain above ground. And we leave our gardens like that during the winter. At the Arboretum, it's nice because we have a lot of critters living in there, and then we have birds of prey looking for critters, and we have turkeys coming through and so forth. So we keep the gardens in, just leave them up during the fall. And in the spring, we come through and either trim or in some cases, we have some areas where we can use prescribed fire to remove that material. It's important, too, from the plant's point of view, to keep the material there because the seeds will be, besides being used by some wildlife as food, they will also be dropping from the plants or dispersed from the plants, flying from the plants, and establishing. So I have gardens where I have lots of native plants that I never planted there. They came in on their own. So I think you can really reduce the amount of work you're doing with it. And if you don't like a, if you don't like the plant stems up during the winter, you will lose something by taking them out, but it doesn't harm the plants to trim them off at the end of the fall, late in the fall, and they'll come back in the spring.
Let's take another call. Dolores in Kenosha up next. Hi, Dolores.
Oh, hi. I have to say I'm proud of our neighborhood because up and down the street, everybody's ripped out the old yews and are planting not so much flowers, but a lot of native shrubs are going in.
Nice.
All different kinds that kind of repeat up and down the street. It's beautiful. My question is slightly off the topic. We're having work done on basement windows, and one spot I have German iris. Now, I know you can divide and replant iris in August. Is it too late for me to take these up, or should I put them in sawdust, something like that, and then put them in, in the spring?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm not too familiar with that, with the practices around that plant, but if you know for sure that putting them in the spring will work, then I would say that. But you could... My advice on something like this also, though, is why don't you try it with the few and see if it works?
Okay.
Try transplanting some of them now and, you know, put the others up the way that you normally would. You know, we've had, I don't know exactly in your area what the conditions have been like, but we've had a very long season for a lot of the blooming times and so on. So the plants, did they bloom for longer than they normally would have this year?
Well, the problem with German iris is that they'll bloom beautifully, and then we get one good rainstorm, and it knocks them over.
Right.
Because they're such a tall plant. And they're older anyway. I should probably separate them out. The soil is still warm in this spot because it's right next to the house, and it's on the west side.
Right.
So.
Well, the soils will remain warm for a long time, so that, you know, the air will cool sooner than the soils will, so you'd still have that advantage. I would say try it with some of them, see if it works,
sure.
And then you'll know more.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Dolores. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Cheryl in Conover next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I am having trouble with purple coneflowers. I buy a perennial from, and I'm up north, way up north, and every year I buy them, it's like they shrivel up. I don't see any bugs on them. I don't see, you know, anything affecting them. They're right next door to black-eyed Susans in my little prairie garden, and I just can't keep coneflowers.
Have you ever had it successful there?
No.
Hmm.
And that's the other point. Now, the black-eyed Susans were successful this summer. Mm-hmm. So at this stage of the game, I'm ready to pull that poor coneflower out. That it's like they got all these buds, and then they just shriveled up like something from the root.
Yeah,
or something.
One thing you might want to do with that is to get is if you have photographs of that kind of sequence, would be to send them into the plant diagnostic lab and see if they can determine any symptoms from your photos or your or your description. But I guess my advice as a gardener would be, it sounds like you've given it a good try, and it might be better to focus on some other plants that will work in your situation. You know, I don't know whether it's the site or the you know, the exposure or just the region on that, or whether there's you know, something in the soil. So but see if you can figure it out from your description with plant diagnostic, and then and then try some other good hardy species for that area.
Yeah, there you go. It's the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic is the official title. If you go online, UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, it's going to pop up. And they're usually, Brian Huddleston's usually pretty good at, if you've got some good photos, he's usually pretty good at providing some help for sure. Thanks, Cheryl, for calling. Let's see, Jenny in Mequon, your turn now. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. About 4 years ago, my husband and I moved to Mequon. We have about an acre, and I'm killing a lot of grass and converting it to prairie. But I'm not so knowledgeable about trees and shrubs. Now, I know to take out buckthorn, and I've been doing that like crazy. But I'm wondering, is there anyone that I could hire to come to my place to walk around and say, okay, this is a variation of buckthorn, it needs to come out, or it's a wild cherry, it should stay? Who could I hire to do this?
Well, it sounds like if you reach if you in your area there in the Mequon area, if you can contact someone who has a landscaping business that also specializes in native landscaping, that might be a focus for you. And you can probably have them just for a one visit. They walk with you on your site and do kind of a walkthrough with you. Another approach might be to take a course on tree and shrub ID. And it sounds like, you know, for your area that would be a really helpful thing. And after a little while, you'll recognize the different species that you're concerned about. Any nature centers in your area who might have this kind of exhibit available would be another good resource for you.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I'd look for a certified arborist, probably, wouldn't you?
Yeah, we have some, I just know locally we have some landscaping companies that specialize also in native, and they do consults like that where they're not actually doing the work, but they're consulting with the landowner and teaching, basically, so that you can get a good start. And believe me, once you've learned them and it won't be too difficult, you'll be looking at your property in a different way.
Take your cell phone along with the camera and shoot photos of those pesky plants and so forth.
Great.
All
Thank
right.
you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Carol in Bailey's Harbor has something for us. Hi, Carol. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to tell people to justify your weeds in your garden and on your lawn for herbicide and pesticide-free. I use the term vintage. So if someone says, oh, you got some weeds there, just use the term vintage, and because that's kind of a in thing right now, and it might get
help
people thinking.
Yeah, and I think it lets you have a conversation more about, well, these, you know, that it's intentional, as our other caller mentioned, and that it's something that you've thought about and that you are doing in a considered way, not just ignoring your yard and letting things go.
Right, and if people would realize, if they just let their lawn go, you don't have to mow it as much.
Exactly.
A lot less work, more time to enjoy life.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you,
Thank
Carol.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Well, let's see. Jim posted a video, a cool video, on Facebook, and it shows his favorite fall flower for pollinators, the turtle head. And it's just coming into bloom, and he's got a nice photo there of those turtle heads. Isn't that pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very neat plant. We have you can see the bee kind of pressing its way into that flower. It's a flower that requires a little bit of work for the bees to get into, but then they come, they can go inside the flower and they affect pollination, and then they come popping out. And so if you're combining this, growing this plant with the bumblebee photography, you just wait patiently and then take a picture of the bumblebee when it comes popping out of the flower and send it to Bumblebee Watch. So that's a great combination.
That is a great combination. Thanks for sending that. Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon. So I have an issue with a native species, the Indian strawberry. I don't know its technical name, but it has gotten to be so bad that I try not to use chemicals on the lawn. I have a extremely bad Creeping Charlie problem in the backyard, and I've been raking that and pulling that out for years now to keep it under control. But the new problem is the Indian strawberry has been literally taking over my backyard to the point where it's choking out the Creeping Charlie. And I don't know how to, it seems the more I pull it, the faster it grows. And I'd rather not use chemicals, but it's reaching a point where I'm just thinking about
using chemicals. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, what color are the flowers of the strawberries that you have?
They're little white flowers.
Right.
And they form the little marble size, hard little strawberries that are unedible.
Okay. Yeah. So it sounds to me like you're struggling with an area of probably, is it intended to be a lawn or?
It is. It's a shady area at the back half of the yard, and it's really covered in shade, and the grass doesn't do well, and that's why the Creeping Charlie is continually taking over back there. But
right. So I guess my suggestion would be, both of the plants that you've described that you're struggling with are very short plants, and neither of them can do very, very well if they're shaded even more by other plants. So you've got the trees, that's providing shade. Now I'm going to suggest maybe converting part of that area to a ground layer vegetation. So put in some beds of plants that are a little bit taller than the ones that you're struggling with, and see if you can reduce their vigor by shading them out more.
And there's some native plants that would work pretty well, aren't there?
Yes, there's woodland plants. I don't know if you, so woodland plants would be the way to go. Not plants that need a lot of sun in this situation, but we have a goldenrod. If you don't mind it being kind of a, you know, just a thick bed. We have a goldenrod called zigzag goldenrod that blooms in shade like that. We have wild ginger, which has a very inconspicuous flower in the spring. That makes us that's a short ground cover. Shorts aster, which can seed, you could seed into the area, see if it would work. I mean, it would be good to pay attention to what kind of soil you have. I'm guessing it's kind of heavy soil.
It is heavy black soil, about 3 feet, 4 feet deep of good old Wisconsin.
You also try some ferns there, and if you try the ostrich fern, it'll give you a little more height, but it'll also spread out. You know, it won't just stay in one little place. It'll spread out a bit over the area. I had a change in heart with Creeping Charlie back a few years ago when I started getting involved with bumblebee conservation. In the spring, when the queen bumblebees are out, they are using the Creeping Charlie flowers as nectar sources while they're getting their colonies established. And so I let it bloom in the spring now, and I work on it later in the summer. So in some ways, it's underneath all of our other plants, Creeping Charlie is really not a very big element, and you're never totally rid of it. But I think you could reduce its vigor a bit, and also the strawberries by putting a little more, because they'll be in the edge of our gardens, but not really all throughout if we have taller plants competing with them.
Yeah, it's about the first thing that flowers.
It blooms very early, yep.
It blooms very, very early, yep. And so the bees can take advantage of it.
They do.
Thanks a lot, Mike, for calling. Good luck. Appreciate your call. I want to give some others a chance to join us. You can phone in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Carolyn and Madison up next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Say stuff about rain gardens, if I'd like that to be part of the conversation anyway.
Okay.
People here?
Sure.
And especially with all the heavy rains we've been getting, I think they'd be really great.
Yeah.
Right. Very good point. So for people who haven't heard too much about rain gardens, a rain garden is an area which can be kind of low-lying. If you're creating one, you can create kind of a basin, and we have lots of resources for kind of how to go about that. But what you want to do is to have an area planted densely with native plants, and usually they can be kind of large plants and kind of a bold garden. And these plants will be, first of all, their root systems have gone down and have created a lot of space for water to infiltrate into the soils in that location. And generally, they're collecting water from a fairly large area, maybe a part of a roof or maybe the whole roof, from a downspout, from a natural swale where water's coming, flowing, near the house or away from the house, hopefully. And so those gardens will then kind of collect the water temporarily. The water will infiltrate, and these plants will use the water and transpire moisture up into the atmosphere, so it's no longer flooding or causing a problem. Now, of course, with a big heavy rain, that garden may become full, like a pond. We have one at the Arboretum that's been in standing water quite a bit this summer. But then gradually over the day or over the by the following day, the water's infiltrated or transpired. So these can be very important. They should be built into housing developments. They should be built into landscaping around homes and in city areas and so forth. And you see them used a lot now, and it's really, really important. So I'm glad you mentioned it. And I do want to point out that we haven't talked about the conference yet this morning,
yeah.
But we do have a workshop about rain gardens at our conference, and that conference is coming up at the Arboretum on September 17th. So among other great workshops there, we have one about creating and selecting plants for your rain garden.
And thanks again, Carolyn. Let's go over some of the other things that are going to be presented at this Arboretum Native Gardening Conference. And again, it's Sunday, September 17th. From 8:45 to 4:40, right?
Yep, it's all day long. We just packed the day full of great informative sessions. So we have we have a workshop. We have sections that people can select. So we have workshop on design, native garden, and planting and maintaining the garden. We have Mariette Nowak, who is an author and expert on birdscaping. So she's going to come in and talk about native plant gardening specifically for birds, which would be an interesting topic for a lot of people. We have PJ Leash coming over for beneficial insects in the garden. So we've talked about larvae a little bit before, butterfly larvae. There's lots of predator insects that are helpful in the gardens and decomposers, of course. So we're going to highlight those with his presentation. We have a workshop about the jumping worms. That's been a really popular topic lately, with people wondering what to do and what their effects will be. So the research that's been done at the Arboretum in the last couple of years, we'll have our ecologist and talking about some of that work and introducing people to more detail about jumping worms. We also have Native Plant Garden Tour, and we have a couple of workshops this year which are a little bit new and will be very interesting. One is about visual tools, different ways to represent your garden through the seasons or through your different gardening activities. And that one will, I think that'll be a really neat one, and it gives some people some tools to they'll be not only inspired, but they'll be prepared to use these tools themselves in their own garden. Sort of a journaling approach, but a more visual approach than just writing or drawing pictures. And then we have a panel discussion about restoring connections to the earth. And these are lessons learned from school and community gardens. So we have several experts in on that to talk about those features.
So lots going on. Is there a fee for our cost?
There is a fee. There is a registration, and it's online at our website, arboretum.wisc.edu. It's right up front, so you won't miss it on our website. And we do ask people to register by September 7th. So we have a few spaces left, and we're glad to have a few more people join us for the day.
Okay. And again, that's September 17th. And go to Arboretum. If you type in UW-Madison Arboretum,
It's going to pop
right up, and you're going to be able to see how you can sign up for it. Our guest today, Susan Carpenter, Senior Outreach Specialist in the UW Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Talking about native plant gardening on this edition of Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here with my guest Susan Carpenter of the UW-Madison Arboretum. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Taking a look at native plants today. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You have a keynoter you didn't mention relating to the gardening conference on September 17th. What's that person going to be talking about?
Well, that's exactly right. We have Benjamin Vogt coming in. He is from, he's an author. He's a garden designer, a native garden designer. And he has just written a new book, and that's called A New Garden Ethic. And he is exploring in that book the psychology, philosophy, ecology, etc. of these kinds of gardens. He's also an avid gardener himself.
Sure.
So he's going to be illustrating with not only his own garden, but client gardens too. And I think there'll be a lot of inspiration and a lot of good information from him. He's from Nebraska, and he owns a company that does design as well. So we're looking forward to having him. The title of the talk is the same as the book, A New Garden Ethic.
Ah, very cool. And I know you folks have walks and tours and stuff that I know you've got a couple coming up.
Yep, that's true. So one way to see some of these native plants is to go on a walk this time of year. Of course, we recommend walking in the prairie, either in the native plant garden, of course, or out on the prairie. So we have two walks coming up in the next two weekends. And so these are walks on Sunday at 1 p.m., and which is when we have a tour every week of the year. So the one coming up on the 3rd is the walk in the Grady Tract, which is across the south of the Beltline, the part of the Arboretum that's over there. And it'll be in the Grady Oak Savanna, which is being restored right now, and the Green Prairie, which is along one of our older prairies there at the Arboretum. And then on the following Sunday, we'll have a walk in the Curtis Prairie, which is right near the visitor center.
Yeah.
So if they just check our, if the viewers just want to check our website and see where those walks are meeting, they're free and open to the public.
Yeah. Sundays at 1.
Sundays at 1.
All right. Well, let's go to Kate in Menasha next. Kate, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to chime in for the woman who is concerned about transplanting irises. I'm not a master gardener, so I don't want to say that. But my family and I have been moving irises around for a long time. We even have irises that belong to our grandfather. And they're like the toughest plant ever. I think you could plant them as long as the ground isn't frozen, just stick them in there, and they just don't care. So I would tell her not to worry. That's it.
All right.
Excellent.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call. She's been doing it a long time. Kel in Sugar Camp, it's your turn. Hi, Kel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. On the patio, as well, I come across a woolly bear going through the desert of the patio, and I'm wondering where to put him, where he'll eat, be able to find something to eat. I would like to know what they eat.
Okay, well, that's a great question, and I can't really answer you with what they eat when they're younger than the stage that you're seeing now. But at this time, the woolly bears will overwinter as caterpillars. So right now, they may not even be feeding. This would be a great question for PJ if he were here. But when a caterpillar is in a wandering stage, it may not be feeding at all, and it may just be going to find a place to, basically they curl up on their side and they overwinter, you know, in vegetation and materials so that they're protected. And that's how they overwinter. And then in the spring, they come out and they go through the rest of their life cycle.
So if you have a place that has some vegetation, a little heavier vegetation, if you put the woolly bear out there, it's probably going to find a spot that it can get under.
Yeah,
the
as
vegetation.
As long as you get it out of harm's way, it's not going to get stepped on or
right.
crushed in them. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And it was a great question about what they eat, so I'll be looking that up.
Thank you, Cal. Karen and Shano, on to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I am going to try to do 3 different wildflowers. I believe them all to be native, and I don't know how to plant them. Monarda, chicory, and wild asters.
Okay. The chicory is not native, and I wouldn't think you'll have, if you were trying to grow it, I don't think you'll have, you know, it'll grow no matter what. The Monarda and the asters, if we think about when they're naturally produced by the plants, the Monarda is already, the seed is already, you know, maturing and inside the seed heads. This year, our Monarda bloomed, you know, tended to have a long bloom time, so some of the seed is not mature yet. But if you take the seed heads and you turn them over and shake them, you can see the dark black seeds are pretty small and they're ready to go. The seeds of most of those plants that you mentioned need to go through a cold, wet period before they will germinate. So the best time to put them down is either now or when you have soil prepared for them, whatever area you're planning to put them in, you want to have that prepared first. And then you simply put the seeds down in good soil contact with the soil, bare soil, and they will go through the winter. And then that will be the cold, moist treatment, and then they'll germinate in the spring. So
if
you do it now, they won't germinate. They won't germinate yet. If you're planning more to plant some grasses, then you would want to wait until it's colder, because you don't necessarily want the grasses would germinate right away, and you don't want them to grow just a little bit and then get frozen.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Karen. And by the way, you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions. Lee in Williams Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Larry. That was my sister from up north just calling. So anyway, it must run in the family. I have a small prairie, 3/4 of an acre, the surveyors say, and I have quite a bit of the wild carrot or the Queen Anne's lace, and I do notice lots of pollinators on those flowers, and but it is getting pretty big. Is it okay to let it go?
Do you have a lot of individuals of it? Is it?
I do.
Is it increasing in? It's increasing,
yes,
in
every
your...
year.
Okay.
Every year.
So, I think if do you work on the area? Do you work on the area like pulling weeds by hand and that kind of thing in that area, or is it?
Yes,
kind of...
I do. I don't use any pesticide. Everything is natural.
Okay. So I guess if you notice that it's increasing, obviously if you leave it, the plant that's blooming is your second year plant. So it's mm-hmm. producing the seed and is dropping the seed in your garden, and then the first year plants are the small rosettes on the ground. And the second year they grow up. So it sounds like you're getting a lot of seed regeneration of Queen Anne's lace in your garden if this has been going on for a while.
About 5 years. Yeah.
Yeah. It is true that the pollinators will visit it, but it's also true that if you can increase the diversity, or if you can substitute other plants for it, then you might find that those are equally or more beneficial to pollinators as well. So I guess, you know, sometimes in a big, big prairie, nothing is done about it because, you know, the way the area is managed, it will become less common. But it sounds like in your case, it's becoming more common. So you might want to take an area and at least get rid of the seed production. And then take a look and see if you can introduce more species, either maybe overseeding or, possibly some planting or dividing to get more diversity in there. Mm-hmm. It's the area that big overseeding might be the way to go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Lee. Chuck in Toma. On to you. Hi, Chuck.
Hello, this is Chuck. I have a question in regards to fireweed and a few other plants like the aster, and I don't know what the name of it is, a big, tall, yellow flower that's blooming right now. What I have is how I can move these things around. I have some of them on my yard, and I want to get them to a different place. How would I go about doing that?
Well, if they're asters, there's lots of big yellow things blooming now because we have very tall sunflowers and that are yellow, and tall compass plants and other things. What you can do is, if you're interested in not moving the plants but just getting more plants to grow in your areas, is to go ahead and, from the plants that you have, wait until the plants are done blooming, and after some time has passed, this you'll notice that the seeds are mature. And in the case of the asters, those are wind dispersed seeds, so they'll be flying around, starting to fly around. And you can collect those and just paper bag and let them, make sure they're kept, and you say paper bag, so that you can get them to dry out and keep and not have moisture in with them. And then you can just plant those, as I mentioned before with another caller, just plant them on prepared soil where you would like them to grow. The asters move around a lot by themselves. They don't have much trouble at all getting started in new places. And the same is true of some of those big sunflowers, and certainly a cup plant or compass plant or some of those large silphiums.
Yeah.
How about fireweed?
Fireweed, I don't grow, so I don't have any experience with propagating that. But it just from its name, you can tell that it will probably, some of these plants need open space to get started. Like fireweed does very well after a burn where there's been an opening of the ground. So the basic point being that if you want seeds to take, they need to have contact with soil, and then they need to be, have a little space to grow. So make sure you're preparing the site ahead of time if you want to get good success of them growing in your yard.
Chuck, thanks a lot for calling. I want to give John and Madison a chance. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. I was just wondering if you have videotaped your prairie tours. My mother-in-law was a prolific gardener, and she had had a stroke some 20 years ago. And I wondered if you have those available or if you've ever thought of doing that for people who are shut in.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. We don't have any of the tours taped now. Of course, they're outdoors walking tours. But that's an interesting idea, and I think that I'll bring that back to the Arboretum and see what people see what our staff thinks about that as an outreach tool. Very nice.
That's not a bad idea at all. And that's something that could wind up on YouTube or something like that as well, and would be quite useful, I would think. On your site, you do have some information that's available for people that they can use, at least in working with their plants.
Right. We do have, there's information on our website. And, of course, our conference is our signature way of communicating with people about the details of native plant gardening. So we do, we have that. We have plant lists and resources that we distribute at the conference. So these are great ideas for outreach. Thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And just as a reminder, the Arboretum's Native Gardening Conference is Sunday, September 17th, and it runs from 8:45 to 4:40, and I hope you'll go to the UW-Madison Arboretum. You'll find out all the information there on how to get involved and what to pay and all that sort of thing. Really, really a great conference. Susan Carpenter, our guest from the UW-Madison Arboretum, our guest on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. We are visiting with Susan Carpenter, the Senior Outreach Specialist in the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. What's your favorite native plant? What questions do you have for Susan? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Susan, let's turn back to the phones here. Scott in Norwalk's been waiting a little bit, so let's go there. Scott, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. And I'll start out with stating what has turned into my favorite prairie plant, and I'd have to go with a cardinal flower. We put in a wet magic prairie a few years ago, and they're just awesome.
Yeah.
Yep, they are.
So, and my question would be, as we're looking at expanding an area of about 16,000 square feet, and we're wondering if there's any advice that Susan can give us on site prep for doing a fall seeding. We've heard that it can be beneficial, especially for forbs, but I'd really appreciate anything that she could offer.
And you have 16,000 square feet that you're going to be planting?
Correct.
And you have what's there now?
Well, it was field, and it was in an EQIP program, and so the boundary was reestablished where what was field, previously a cornfield, this year it's just been fallow, and so we've got this strip that we need to expand into the EQIP prairie.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So right now that area is just a fallow. It's just a fallow one year beyond being corn, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much like small foxtail and dandelion and whatever
ragweed
and
yeah.
Okay.
And I have mowed it, but there's still a lot of whatever seed bank in there and stuff too. So
yeah,
from weeds.
Okay. Well, there's. Every site has got its own, unique features as well. So, is the adjacent area is a prairie in pretty good shape?
Well, we're like everyone, battling a few things we'd like to see sure. less of. Goldenrod, the Canadian, I guess, is probably, you know, one of the worst problems. But we'd like to see a few more forbs showing up again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Indian grass and, to a lesser extent, big blue stem is in there. But the Indian grass seems to be a little more, what do you want to say, aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. so we're thinking if we could maybe just stick to, you know, like maybe big and little blue stem for grasses and try to get, you know, another selection of forbs going. And
mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, somewhere we had read or heard that, you know, fall seeding for forbs is good, but.
Right.
You know, I'm not positive.
Well, the fall seeding is good for forbs because, as I mentioned before in talking with another caller, the forb seeds generally need a cold, moist stratification period. So if you put them down in the fall, they go through winter, and then they're ready to germinate in the spring. So that's an advantage there. The grasses can do it that way, or they can do it, you know, at any time of year, really. They don't have that same requirement for the most part. So I guess depending on how many perennial, if there's any, I wouldn't think you'd have very many perennial weeds in your new area since it was corn prior, but I could be wrong about that. Do you have any thistles or perennial weeds in that new?
Not too much. The dandelions are probably the worst, and then of course there's, you know, quack grass and, you
right.
know, that type of thing too, but,
right. Okay, well, it could be that you'd want to it could be depending on the density of you know, some of the plants that are existing there or actually what they are in detail. What I'd say is what I'd suggest is making a list of all the plants that you have in there. For example, dandelions are not going to be a problem if you can get your prairie established. And your mowing idea is good because when you seed your area for the first few years on this new area, you're going to be trying to keep it mowed at about a foot or 10 inches to a foot tall throughout the season. And that will allow your native plant seeds that are germinating and growing to establish their root systems and begin to grow slowly up. And the fast-growing weeds, you'll be topping them off. And then after a couple of years of doing that, you'll let it go, and your seed mix will hopefully be the main thing that you see. See. So if you are, if you have any questions or details about your site that you need specific advice about, there are often the native plant nurseries here, you know, in our state, Prairie Nursery, Prairie Moon Nursery in Minnesota. They have extensive sections of their website and of their catalogs that talk about that preparation and the individual part of it that, you know, might apply just to your site. And they will also provide advice if you can profile your site. They can also provide advice that's specific to your situation. So I would recommend that for site prep. You're right to emphasize site prep because it's so important, and if you don't put a lot of thought into it, you can end up with really unsatisfying results. And we just mentioned you'd spend a couple of years to find that out. So good to tend to the specifics of that. And I just make a list of the species that you have and check those resources and see if you've got basically got problems that you can just overcome without too much extra work, or whether you should put some more investment in the prep to begin with.
There we go. And Prairie Nursery, as you mentioned, is a good one. There are some others out there as well, but I know Prairie Nursery has a lot of information on it. So good luck, Scott.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You know, we have a nice photo up on Facebook from Andy and wondering what this very pretty plant is.
Yep.
With kind of a very light purple, would you say?
Yep. This is a flower? Plant that is, it's going to surprise us maybe, because it's a very small flower, and the plant itself usually stands about a foot tall, but its closest relatives are the great blue lobelia, which is more of a wetland plant, and the cardinal flower. So this is a lobelia, and it's this pale blue spiked lobelia. So it is a plant of dry habitats. The last place that I saw a whole bunch of them was on a very dry remnant prairie on a drumland. But I get this plant. We have this plant in one of our gardens, and it loves to seed in the flagstones. It's a perfect habitat for seeds within the flagstones, and has a little flat rosette, and then it puts up a little spike like this. So yeah, Andy, that's a lobelia.
There we go. Francesco in Sister Bay, we turn to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a man approaching 80 years old. I used to be a migrant worker from Texas to here, and we never used herbicides. The farmers never did. We pulled the weeds. The farmers never used insecticides. They didn't have to. The farmers did not use fertilizer. They didn't need just manure. And they were getting making a living very well. Now I'm making a plea to everybody, farmers and gardeners. Please don't use herbicides. Pull the weeds. Don't use insecticides. You don't need it. Don't put too much fertilizer. That is synthetic fertilizer. You're ruining yourself. You're ruining the water table. We're messing up our environment.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Francesco. Comment from you, Susan Carpenter.
Well, I think this is some advice that goes along very well with native plant gardening, because it turns out that when we're using the plants that are adapted to our environment here, those practices are not really included in our gardening practices. And also, when we have, you know, we have native plants growing near our vegetable crops and our vegetable gardens or fruit gardens, we actually have an added benefit of having native plants to support the pollinators that do increase the yields and the quality of the fruit and vegetables, many of the vegetables that we grow. So these things can go side by side, and it does save you, it does save a lot of input, it saves expense, and it saves environmental effects to not use those chemicals. Well, thanks for your comment.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling, Francesco. Appreciate it very much. Buzz sent us a photo. He said he started with 2 acres of prairie about 25 years ago.
And there's the photo, and it's a beautiful, beautiful image.
Beautiful, beautiful prairie. So thank you very much for sending that photo. You can send one, too, at our Facebook page, The Larry Mealer Show. We'd certainly love to see that. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org with questions, or go to our Facebook page, again, at The Larry Mealer Show, or phone 800-642-1234. We always, of course, love to hear from you. And we can take some other calls as well. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. And a caller coming up, get him on pretty quickly here. Terry in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
We have a rather large project going on. We need some landscape cleared, and I was wondering, instead of going to each individual landscape company and asking them for a bid, is there a website that we can get a general idea of the cost for the whole works being done, or do I have to call an individual landscaper and have them come out and do a bid?
I think you can get, I mean, if you have a rather large area, you're probably planning to handle that. You know, you'd have two aspects to it. One would be the site preparation, as we've been talking about, and the other would be the cost of the plant materials, so either plants or seeds.
Or a combination, yes.
Large areas, usually people are going with seeds, depending on what kind of area it is. If it's a wooded, more wooded or shaded area, perhaps seeds aren't the way to go. But say it's, what kind of area is it? All prairie?
Well, I'm talking more about having it cleared, brushed, you know, trees chipped.
Okay.
And stuff like that.
That's part of the site preparation.
Right.
So I think you can, you can get an idea of the different pieces of it, but it sounds like if you're looking to hire someone to do the entire job or to do, you know, the two parts of it, you're going to probably need, you know, realistic bids from them for your site. You could get an idea if you know the acreage or the, you know, the area, you could get an idea if you're going to do it with seed about what the cost of the seed would be, because you can go on to one of the seed suppliers' websites and you can see, you know, you can look at the cost for that amount of area. But it sounds like you have pretty extensive
clearing.
Yes, and that's going to be, you know, that might be
a separate group.
Yeah, it might be a separate company, or you might take it in two phases like that, or you might have one stop company that could handle the whole thing. So much of this is going to depend on the details of the amount of brush, the size of the trees that are removed, and so forth. But it sounds like an ambitious project, and I hope it goes well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're going to need to really talk to some people on the phone and maybe get them out there to look at the site. I think a large area like that, you're not going to have a problem getting people to come out, I don't think, and look and give you an estimate. And any of the nurseries, Prairie Nursery and the like, are always, I think those folks are, that's what they do. They're happy to do it. Nikki in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great.
Okay, so my question is, I have a bed of native perennials that I'm planning on moving.
You are totally breaking up. Unfortunately, moving flowers and...
If you have established plants now that you'd like to move, there's two times to, if they're perennials, kind of two times to do it. One would be, you definitely want to do it after they've bloomed. So if a plant is actively blooming, you don't want to be moving it then. But in early in the spring, for things that are that bloom in the summer, you can do that because you're kind of taking advantage of the natural time when the plant wants to get established and grow. And this time of year isn't bad either if they've already finished blooming, because the plants will still have several months remaining where the soil is still warm enough for them to get established with some root system. Nothing will happen above ground, but you could still establish the plant below ground and be ready to go next spring. So those are my suggestions for perennials, and I'm sorry we couldn't hear your question better if it was a different question than that.
Thank you, Nikki, for calling. I'm sorry we couldn't get you through here. Let's go to Merrimack and talk to Dan next. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, not a problem, Larry. Thanks. I've got a small corner of my lot. I'm on Lake Wisconsin that is continually shaded, a lot of trees that I'm getting tired of mowing. But it's always under shade.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would like to put in something that is what can be well established. I've got a lot of vinca and everything on my lot for shoreline, but I'd like to have something that looks a little better under that shaded corner.
Okay.
Well, if it's deep, deep shade, shade is a thing that can vary from light shade to heavy shade. But if it's deep, deep shade, probably the grass isn't growing very well anyway, and you've got bare soil or just, you know, minimal grass.
I do have some grass that grows.
Okay.
It's a little sun in the afternoon, but...
Okay.
Okay.
So you can convert that over, depending on how much sun and how much shade, you can convert that over to using either woodland plants ferns, for example. I mentioned earlier the ostrich fern is one that if it's an area where you're not wanting to do a lot of intensive gardening, but you just kind of want to have a nice medium height ground cover there, ostrich fern may work. And you do want to match the plants, of course, to the soil conditions. But if you put in an ostrich fern and it likes it there, you'll get a lot more ostrich fern. And then you could also use some other semi-shade plants if it's getting a lot of sun from, you know, exposure from the west during the afternoon. That it may be a plant that's more suited to a savanna environment would be good. Some of our asters are useful in that way, or some of the hyssops could be one of our hyssops could work, giant purple hyssop, if you want something pretty tall. As long as it's not, you know, dark shade, some of those savanna plants will work well as well.
It'd be great. I just, you know, and it's kind of a drainage area, and, you know, I need to hold up that.
You want a ground cover, really, with it, right?
Yeah.
Plants to hold. So you want to get the plants planted in there kind of densely and maybe, you know, so that they'll hold on to the soil in that drainage area.
Would those ferns do that? Those ferns would.
The ferns will be pretty. They'll be pretty thick, and they have a very substantial root system.
Yeah.
So I mean, having them combined with other plants that, you know, will seed amongst there might be a good approach in that situation.
Yeah, I think.
I'm thinking that I got a good spot for it, and it doesn't get a boatload of sun until later in the day.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes those areas that get no sun for half the day and full sun for the rest of the day can be tricky, but I think that's where I like to think about the savanna plants, because they can often make a go in it.
Yeah, and the fern again that you were recommending?
Well, the ostrich fern is one that spreads, it spreads itself by rhizomes or underground stems. So if it's if you plant one, it doesn't just stay as
sit
one
there.
Plant. It keeps it will spread in suitable.
But it won't
spot.
Go out of areas where it's not where it doesn't like it.
Right, it won't go where it doesn't like to. It'll go everywhere where it does like.
There we go. Well, let's go back to the Native Gardening Conference again. Go over with us. What we can expect to see at this conference on September 17th.
Yes, well, our conference we start out the day with workshops, or we have workshops throughout the day, and we have a keynote speaker at 3 o'clock. So our keynote speaker this year is Benjamin Vogt. He's an author with a brand new book that just came out. And his book is called A New Garden Ethic, where he kind of works as takes inspiration from Leopold's land ethic, but he brings it into a gardening context. And so a lot of the things that we value about native gardening will be in this talk. Wildlife habitat. He's bringing in philosophy, psychology, ecology to this topic. And I think it'll be inspirational, and certainly with his work as a landscape designer and an author, he's really bringing these together and will have a lot of good illustrations for us. We also have on our workshops, we have those three sessions during the day, and we have design, planting, maintaining, we have birdscaping, we have a session about invasive jumping worms. It's exciting.
So there's lots going on.
Rain gardens. Beneficial insects.
Go to the UW-Madison Arboretum website.
Yep.
You're going to find out.
And registration's there, and we want everyone to register by September 7th so we can have food and everything available for the lunch.
Susan, thank you so much. Susan Carpenter, Senior Outreach Specialist in the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. And thank you so much for listening. Bill Volker comes by on Monday to talk about birds on this Labor Day. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.